Thank you very much, Jared, for those kind words. I'm really pleased to be able to introduce our panelists today. It's a pleasure to have them all here, welcome them back to their old law school, and they all have distinguished careers and are now serving in fascinating positions. To my left, all the way down, is Jeff Ferguson of the class of 91, who is currently the general counsel to the Carlyle Group. For those of you not familiar with it, the Carlyle Group is a global private equity investment firm that has some $44 billion of equity capital under management. Jeff is a double who, graduated from the college in 1987. And he has worked at the firm of Latham & Watkins, I believe in Washington.
Yes.
And is now, as I say, general counsel to the Carlyle Group. Immediately to my left is Tom Sidman of the class of 79, who is co-founder and executive vice president of business processes. For business processes of the Siren Call Communications Corporation. Siren is a startup entity formed in early 2006 that has proposed and is seeking to implement innovative public-private partnership approach to provide broadband wireless mobile communication services to public safety and other first responder groups throughout the United States. From 1994 to 2001, Tom was the general counsel of Nextel Communications Incorporated, and after leaving there, he continued to provide legal advice to Nextel. On my immediate right is Sharon Owlett of the class of 75, who is now vice president and senior counsel of Nortel Government Solutions. Nortel Government Solutions is a subsidiary of Nortel Networks, an international telecommunications product and solutions provider that is based in Canada. And Nortel Government Solutions provides end-to-end IT solutions to government agencies. Ms. Owlett was for 16 years vice president and general counsel of PEC Solutions Incorporated, which was the predecessor to Nextel. And in that role, she oversaw or helped to develop the structure of the company, including human resources, finance and accounting, facilities, contracts and purchasing, government securities and media relation. She tried to get out. They wouldn't let her. And when Nortel acquired PEC in 2005, they talked her into coming back as general counsel, vice president and senior counsel. All the way down on my right is Byron Marchant of the class of 1987. He is executive vice president, general counsel, and chief administrative officer of BET Networks. Reading what he does within the company is really quite extraordinary. It shows you some of the pies that lawyers can get their fingers into. He is the administrator of the following departments: legal affairs, human resources, computer information systems, broadcast operations, satellite operations, telecommunications, facilities, real estate, and corporate purchasing. I don't know what he does in his spare time, but...
come down here.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things he does in his spare time is he comes down here and teaches as an adjunct on our law faculty. And before joining BET, Byron was with Sidley and Austin and with Telecommunications Systems Incorporated of Annapolis. All these people share, I think, a unique insight that I hope will be we can explore, and that is what it's like to work for one entity on the inside as opposed to being an outside counsel. Oh, I'm sorry. Usually I'm my mother always told me I shouted too loud. I apologize. And so I'd like to start out, toss out a question for all of our panelists to begin our discussion, and that is, what is it like to be an in-house lawyer, and what about that particular role has made for an exciting and interesting career path for you? And why don't we start with Jeff down in the...
Thank you, Professor Dudley. Good afternoon. I hope you can all hear me well. I think the Carlyle Group I was telling our panelists before we started has really been the only client I've ever had, even though when I left law school I worked in one of the big law firms. It so happens that the founders of the Carlyle Group sublet office space from the law firm, and I, as a summer associate, was the cheapest labor that could be assigned to three guys who no one knew what they were going to do. And I've been working with them ever since. So, first of all, to contrast it or compare it to anything else, I don't really have the data to do that. But what I do enjoy about my current role is I started off life really as a tax lawyer, which I thought was fun and interesting and incredibly intellectual. That's what I wanted to do with my entire career. Now my practice scans all sorts of areas of law here in the U.S., ranging from antitrust to patent and trademark protection. M&A activity is what I really do most of, actually cross-border M&A transactions. But any area of law in the U.S. and in 14 or 18 different countries or so is essentially what I do. I get to travel a great deal, and it is far more exciting than working in a law firm ever promised to be from my perspective. I would predict that most of you don't really know what Carlyle is. We raise money from big institutions and invest it for them in a nutshell, but Carlyle is really a collection of about 1,800 different partnerships that are pretty complex. So I am in charge of all legal affairs for all 1,800 partnerships all over the world. That means I'm pretty busy. I didn't bother to list all the things I try to do because in any given day it's more than I can certainly count. But it's a very varied practice and challenging.
I had a similar experience, although I wasn't there for the office space sublet. But I started working for Nextel, which at that time was called Fleet Call, in 1988. They were formed in 1987, so I missed the first year. But I was on the outside at Jones Day in Cleveland, of all places, for the first 6 years of my association with them. Then left Jones Day, went in house in 94. And I can truly say it really is like night and day. And being on the outside and counseling people and being on the inside, you get to see the contrast, because the things that you just absorb by virtue of being within the four walls of your client are things that... You can believe people don't deliberately withhold information from you, but you almost feel like a doctor, and you're treating people based on how they describe their symptoms, and then you do something and it hurts and you say, oh, well, of course, I see what's the problem, but you never told me about that other thing. When you're in-house, you get a lot more of the view of everything, which is the good part. Two kind of offsets to that, probably actually three. One is, when you're outside, the resources at your disposal are incredible. You'll probably never be outside of the time you leave law school among a smarter group of legally inclined people than you will be at a law firm. The expertise you can get by walking down the hallway is astounding. Inside, the level of talent, I think, is not anywhere near what you'd find at a law firm, and that's, I think, appropriate to a large corporation. I mean, there's a lot of folks in there who are good at what they do, but they're not going to be subject matter experts. They don't aspire to be that, and they've made trade-offs, and there's nothing wrong with that. The other is, when you're on the outside, you have something that needs to be typed and ready at 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, you go down to the all-night IT center. You drop off the paper. There's somebody who comes in all day long, all night long, and it's waiting for you in the morning. When you're there at 9 o'clock at night and watching the cleanup crew come in, and you look around, and it's what's at the end of your arms that's your typing pool, That's a little bit of a different experience. The other, which is a huge difference, is when you're in a law firm, you are in fact a revenue generator. When you go in-house, you're a cost center. And let me tell you, there's no respect you get internally at a corporation like saying, yes, that's right, I don't raise revenue, I help you get rid of it. So it's a challenge, it's a different experience, but you learn a whole new set of skills, you learn a whole new different perspective, and you can basically, I think, get a lot of value just out of being in the space and a part of the team. So,
sure.
I never worked in a firm. I actually started out in politics and journalism and somehow ended up in business, which was a slight detour. But the thing that I like most about corporate practice, or one of the things that I like most, is, you know, you have a stake in what you do. You have a personal stake in what you do every day. The advice that you give to the people in your corporation affects you. You know, it affects your livelihood. It affects your potential for growth. If your company grows, you have the opportunity to do a lot of new and different things. You know, if your company, for example, is a U.S.-based company and that's all that you do, and then your company decides to branch out overseas, well, there's a lot of new things that you can take up and that you can learn. And you do have the opportunity to get your fingers in every single part of the business. You know, legally and administratively, you know, what I did for my company, what Byron's doing for his now, are very, very similar in that we were involved in a lot of non-legal things as well as being involved in legal parts of the business. And I think it's one of the best jobs that an attorney can have. It really is. And it changes daily. It's very, very exciting.
Good afternoon. I can give you the formal explanation of what a general counsel does, and then I can give you what really goes on. Yesterday is probably an example of what really goes on. I work with entertaining people, most of whom make me laugh, but they're actually working behind the scenes to create content that makes other people laugh. Yesterday I was in Atlanta as part of my role and responsibility to address the community regarding BET's production of a hip-hop award show in Atlanta coming up in November. So my day started with briefing the mayor's staff of the city of Atlanta about our plans for the show, then talking to the community business groups who would be affected by our involvement in the city of Atlanta in November. Then I talked to the police, fire, and emergency responder teams about the risk of the Hip Hop Award Show in Atlanta. And then I talked to our internal group about the risk of the Hip Hop Award Show in Atlanta and went through all the legal requirements, et cetera, et cetera. And during one part of my briefing, someone said to me, well, when you're running security for the event, can you just tell the guys to put the guns on the ground of the automobile so they don't carry them in the theater, and that way we don't have to find out if they have them or not. Of course, as general counsel and an ethical officer of the company, I said, you know, I don't want to get into warrantless searches as part of our hip-hop award show. But the real point of that story is that as general counsel, your life melds into the business, and you end up rendering essentially business judgments, ethical judgments, corporate governance judgments as it relates to your fiduciary responsibility to the corporation. More times than not, you're elevating the business discussion to a higher level of what the ethics and the corporation have to do as a function of the community responsibility of the company's business, the corporate responsibility of the contractual obligations, and the risk that the company is undertaking at any given time it's in the community. So I share that story with you to say that as a general counsel, ultimately to gain standing in the company, people are aware that you may be a cost center, but more often than not, I've found that your value is in being a facilitator of business and revenue while mitigating the risk, ethics, and corporate governance responsibilities that the company still has to maintain. One of the other things I think about being a general counsel that's really interesting, and I think everybody said it, is you do really need to know the business. I often have hired UVA law grads from different parts of life to join me on my staff, and the first thing I say to them is, I need you to know how to read a financial statement. I need you to understand how to decipher EPA regulatory requirements. I need you to understand the alphabet soup of the regulations that affect us and how many agencies affect us. At the end of the day, to really be effective in-house counsel today, you really are an expert, essentially on behalf of the company, about the panoply of the government, regulatory, corporate governance, and contractual business issues that face the company. And I find it interesting. I think, like everybody else on this panel, though, you work long hours, and you really have to be into what you do to make it work.
I want to pick up on something that both Byron and Sharon alluded to, and that is the sense that you have a stake in what you do, and the sense that you are very much involved in the ethical governance of a corporation. Is there a tension there? Is there something of an inevitable tension between your role in making the business profitable, helping the business work, and your role in seeing to it that the business complies with the law, particularly when you're viewed as a cost center and you, what you suggest may be indeed costly to the corporation? And I ask the question, obviously, in light of the fairly significant number of corporate scandals we've had in recent years where corporations have simply lost sight of their ethical norms. Why don't we start with you, Bob?
You know, I think that's one of the benefits of UVA law and kind of the underpinning of the honor code and the kind of character that UVA tries to build in general. To really be an effective in-house counsel today, I don't think you should end up in a scandal headline. My belief is that if you've compromised your ethics and your integrity by essentially compromising your ethical and fiduciary responsibility as an officer of the company, but particularly as an officer of the court in many ways, then I think you've essentially compromised yourself and your professional reputation. So while I empathize with some of the headlines where I see general counsels also going down with the ship as part of the scandal, my personal belief is that you're better off resigning than being compromised in that way. And so I think companies are coming around to that. I'm fortunate to be inside of Viacom, where the new CEO of Viacom is the former general counsel of Viacom. The current CEO of BET is the former general counsel of BET. Makes a huge difference in their methodology and their analysis of what constitutes good business decision making, what constitutes reasonable business risk. I think that there's a lot of merit, frankly, in MBA students who become potentially CEOs of companies, spending more time not only on ethics, but also on legal training and in the role of ethics and legal training and governance, because I think we may get, you know, better boards of directors and better corporate officer suites if we had more lawyers, believe it or not, closer to the top of the corporation, also ran the corporation. So that's my opinion.
Tom, how do you deal with the situation where you have a view as to what the law requires your company to do, and that view happens to be fairly expensive and unprofitable, and the guy is looking at you and saying, okay, I view you as a cost center. How do you internally deal with that kind of problem?
Well, I think it kind of plays into a stereotype that people have in the corporate world that in-house lawyers, or for that matter, outside lawyers, are deal killers or impediments to conducting business. And I would say, frankly, even based on the companies that I worked for when I was in private practice, certainly at Nextel, that's not the way that it plays out in real life. I'm old school, but I think they're dishonest people, and they do dishonest things. You have bad CEOs, you have bad CFOs, you have bad priests, you have bad doctors, probably have bad garbage men too, but I don't know what they do and how it affects anything. But in any event, it's to presume that corporations, I think, have an overwhelming desire to do things that are either illegitimate or to do legitimate things in illegal ways is totally foreign to my experience. And I think, realistically, your job as a general counsel is to basically get across to people what I think they know at some level, whether they want to admit it or not. If it's a legitimate thing that a business ought to be doing, there's virtually no way that you can get an absolute no, you can't do it. But there is a way that you get an answer that says, if you intend to do it, you should do it in particular ways. And I think Byron raised a good point that you develop business skills, so a lot of the advice that you give, while it can be kind of legally flavored and legally oriented, a lot of times also is practically oriented. I mean, for instance, Nextel was picking up companies right and left for the better part of 6 years, and integrating companies in merger scenarios is a very difficult and a painful process. And after you've been through it a few times, you know a lot of things that are not strictly legal, but that are valuable items of knowledge that you can pass along to business people. And I always found that basically the thing to do was to sit down and say, okay, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do it? What are the objectives? What's the steps? What are the goes? And then basically go back and think about it and come back and say, this is what I think is the best way to get there, including the way to get there in compliance with the relevant laws. And people will, of course, push back and say, do we really need to do X? Do we really need to meet the construction deadline? Can't we just fudge it? No, you can't just fudge it. But it'll cost more if we do it than if we don't. Yes, you're right. It'll cost more to give your employees a paycheck that won't bounce on payday, too. But you know what? You do it because in the long run, that's going to be something that is ultimately good for the business. I mean, I think you'd be surprised that within a company, you're more apt to find a long-term view than you are in the pool of people who hold the equity interests in that company. They're more interested in, what are you worth next Tuesday? The people who are inside are more interested in, where are we going next year, next decade?
Does that accord with your experience, Sharon?
Absolutely. People in general, my experience with all the people I've worked with in business, by and large, is, you know, they really want to know how to do it right. You know, they want to know how to make money and they want to know how to be efficient. But, you know, they're generally not a whole lot of dishonest people out there. You know, there really aren't. And they're trying to have you help them find the best way to get to where they need to be. And they'll come to me a lot of times and say, okay, I trust you to tell me how to do this right. And I trust you to keep me out of trouble. You know, what is it that I need to do? And I think a lot of times the key is with business people is, you know, they don't understand the law. They don't have an appreciation for a lot of the nuances. What you have to do is explain it to them. You know, you have to talk in language that they can understand. And sometimes you have to walk them through it step by step, and something that is intuitively obvious to you is not intuitively obvious to them. And so lots of times it's not that they're resisting you, they don't understand what it is that you're trying to explain to them about why it is that you can't do something a particular way or why you have to do something else. But once you explain it to them, they usually are pretty good about understanding. And another thing that I found is the law. There are lots of legal paths to take to lots of places. And sometimes business itself is more inflexible than the law is. You can say, okay, you want to get to point A, you have this legal alternative, this legal alternative, this legal alternative. And the business interest says, well, I don't want any of those alternatives. You know, you've got to find me another way. And hopefully you'll find, you know, a fourth way to get to that point A. But there are a lot of different ways to skin a cat, which is what I always tell the guys that I work with. It's true. You just have to appreciate enough of the business interests, and they have to be willing to trust you enough that you all can work together and get to where you need to be.
Picking up on something that Tom said a little while ago, which is deals with the information flow within a company. In your experience, Jeff, do you have a hard time getting the information that you need and in order to advise the company on its legal and ethical obligations? And how do you deal with that sort of a problem? Is it a function in part of people not understanding the law, or is it a function of something else?
Well, actually, I do not perceive an inability to get access to the information we need. I think in large part that's a function of your personal relationship with the business people at the firm. And I mean, as I mentioned a minute ago, I've had a personal relationship with the founding partners for, you know, over 20 years. So every morning I walk into their office and we sit down, and talk about different issues that are we're going to have to face that day, and we do it really collectively. Every Sunday morning we have breakfast out at a hotel. So I think there is an immense flow of information. I think there's probably too much information. In today's internet world, I find I spend all day reading email, and it's more information than one person can absorb. I have a staff in-house, of 18 lawyers, and you have to rely on them a great deal. My personal preference, my personality, my tendency is to get involved in any particular transaction and try probably too much to understand all of the details. The greatest challenge for me is to delegate to other people and trust them to handle any kind of issues that arise, whether they're ethical or what have you. In addition, Carlyle, I think, is perhaps unique from other companies represented here in that there are lawyers crawling all over Carlyle. Our business is really to engage in heavily negotiated securities transactions. We buy majority stakes in operating companies. We don't really make anything. We just invest money. But over a 6 or 9 month period, you negotiate the acquisition of controlling interest in large companies like Dunkin' Donuts or Hertz. As a result, there are lawyers. Our legal budget exceeds probably $150 million in any given year, and access to information is not something I worry about because I sort of have deputized outside counsel who are all over everything that happens at Carlyle, and whenever there's a problem, it comes back to me. And fortunately, Carlyle takes very seriously our fiduciary duties to our limited partners who invest with us, and as a result, I think the access to information is simply not something I've ever thought of as being a problem. My concern right now, again, is too much information to sort through.
Let me ask a slightly different kind of question. What sort of relationship do you have with outside counsel? When do you hire outside counsel, and how do you relate to them in the performance of what kinds of things do you ask them to do, and how do you relate to them in the performance of those? Right?
I guess, a quick answer is I retain outside counsel when the budget allows it. But usually I'll go to outside counsel for sometimes advice in areas of the law that I'm really not that up to date in, or I don't have that much depth in. Or I'll go to them and there's a large, discrete matter that has to be dealt with. I mean, obviously, when we've done acquisitions, we've gone to outside counsel to help us work on those acquisitions. We don't begin to have the staff in-house to do those kinds of things. And I think everybody works out their own different relationship with outside counsel and what you expect of outside counsel. I expect them, for one thing, I expect them to ask questions and listen to what not only what I have to say, but what the people in my company have to say. Lots of times, outside counsel is too almost narrow in its focus. We're providing you legal advice, and we're the experts in this, and this is what we're going to tell you to do. And they don't take enough time to listen to the business people in the company, to understand the business, to understand what their constraints are, to understand what their goals are. And I think it's important for those of you who are going to be outside counsel and who deal with business to understand, and that's actually one of those things that article over there points out, to understand that you really need to be receptive to your client, responsive to your client. Number one, it's going to help you get a lot more business. Number two, it's going to help you do your business better. And number three, it's going to endear you to the people there who, after all, are very, very smart and expert people in their own rights. It's going to make them recognize the fact that you appreciate them, therefore they'll appreciate you, therefore next time I need to go outside for additional help, they won't tell me, don't ever bring those guys back in here.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the career path of in-house counsel. When should it start? What do you look for? Should people be looking to go into in-house jobs straight out of law school? Should they train? Is there some valuable training that they can get before becoming in-house counsel? I'll start with Byron.
I debate this all the time when I'm hiring people, but I've decided ultimately that the most valuable hires on my staff, and I have several UVA law grads, come from people who've been outside first. Particularly people who've been outside both in law firms and in government potentially, since I'm in an industry where there's a lot of alphabet soup government regulation as well. So my own personal experience coming out of here was it was worthwhile to be in a law firm, and I've done it. I did it twice, once at Sidley and Austin and once at Patton and Boggs. And in both cases, it helped me perfect the type of service and efficiency that I'm now demanding out of my outside counsel. So in one way, I think you gain a lot of perspective and education as an in-house counsel. But on the other hand, I think developing your bona fides outside for a while and establishing expertise in areas relevant to being a business lawyer are key. A lot of people gain relationships as a result of being outside counsel with the CEOs and general counsels of companies. From time to time, that happened in my case with respect to BET, and it was all because I was doing the right thing at the right time, doing what I like to do, but in a role outside, either in government or with a law firm.
You mentioned, Jeff, that you have a staff of 18. Did you build that staff by seeing that you had a need for a particular expertise and going to hire somebody who had that, or did you build it in a different way?
No, I did exactly. My preference is actually to hire only people from fairly large law firms with a significant amount of experience in a particular subject matter area. For example, if I need a securities lawyer, I've chosen to go hire a securities lawyer with a fair amount of experience from one of the Wall Street firms, for example. Or if I need an ERISA lawyer, I'll hire somebody with ERISA experience. I'll be the first to admit you make mistakes, and while that was my intent, and I've hired a lot of people with specific subject matter expertise, it turns out that the work you're actually doing in-house is frequently not related to your subject matter expertise. As a result, people fairly quickly become generalist. That's not always true. They always cling to their expert subject matter. But very quickly, you will find tax lawyers dealing with securities law issues, or you're working on a transaction in Japan and you have to accommodate somehow the Japanese securities law issues relating to some fairly esoteric issues. You suddenly cease to think about the Internal Revenue Code, and all of a sudden you're working with Japanese lawyers, and your legal training is more important than your subject matter expertise. Having said that, I still believe that the experience you get in a big firm, how to analyze issues, you have to spend a fair amount of time, I think, doing research, learning how judges analyze issues. You have to have a fair amount of time in a big law firm working only with lawyers, how a transaction is consummated. That's key experience, and I would probably not hire, for example, anyone straight out of law school to work at Carlyle, because I don't think they would have the right background to jump into the transactions, and I don't think the business people would have the confidence. As smart and talented as you are, I think the confidence issue would be pretty significant. So I tend to hire people who have their own bona fides that were developed from some of the big firms.
Tom, can you tell us about your experience in that regard, and maybe give some advice to students who might think they want to be in-house counsel someday. How should they go about preparing themselves for that career path?
Well, I think probably not the way that I did. I took probably the most circuitous route that anyone would take in their right mind if their ultimate objective was to become the general counsel of a telecom company. First, I spent my entire practice career in Cleveland, a hotbed of the telecom industry. Second, I did absolutely no work for a telecom company before I did work for a fleet call. Third, I didn't even necessarily want to do work for Fleet Call. It just happened to be that one of the guys that I was on a deal with was the regular lawyer for Fleet Call, who at that time was a fly speck of a company of the law firm. And he was on his way overseas, and they came to him and needed something done. We had just worked on a project that had fallen apart. He couldn't take it on because he was leaving the country, being that he owed me one, he said, "Gee, I think I have a friend in Cleveland who has some free time on his hands. Let me give him a call." But it actually turned out incredibly serendipitously well. One of the things that I did in my early career at Jones Day was work for an iron ore company who put together partnerships, so I got to know joint ventures. The first thing that I did for Fleet Call was to structure a joint venture for them. Another thing is they're prodigious users of money, as are iron ore mines, oddly enough. And indentures tend to be kind of the documents of choice for people raising large amounts of money. You can go through downtown Cleveland shouting, "Can I have an indenture lawyer?" And probably no one will raise their hand and say, "Yes, me." But I could have. I was probably one of the few people outside of New York, Chicago, or L.A. who actually had day-to-day fairly intensive experience with indentures. And we ultimately raised probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 to $9 billion using those pieces of paper. I got basically involved with an oil additives company who happened to be dabbling in venture investment. And so I got hooked up with their venture group in-house because, frankly, there were no venture investing lawyers in Cleveland at that time. There was a very small venture investing community in Cleveland, and there still is. So a variety of things that were very useful to my career. I got them by happenstance. I got them purely by coincidence, and it just so happened that the planets aligned so that turned out to be exactly the right preparation for what I became and where I wound up. And being able to make actual contributions as opposed to saying, "Gee, I don't know anything about that." By the same token, the guy who is now the general counsel of Nextel is an FCC expert, and I thought I had a good day if I got the letters in the right order. So that is kind of, I think, the moral. You can't be everything all the time, and sometimes the most logical thing to be is not concentrating in a subject area. But I would say actually today, if I wanted to be a general counsel, I think I'd be an assistant U.S. attorney somewhere, some large metropolitan area, New York, Chicago, Washington. Because they seem to be basically the people who have the facility and the expertise of dealing with the government, and I think increasingly, at least in large corporations, the government tends to be who you can predictably expect to deal with, and it is largely, I think, the largest context in which those dealings are especially stressful, where you would want to have some legal skill set along with a government understanding set on your side, being basically the corporation's front person. So.
Sharon, are there companies out there that do hire for their in-house staff straight out of law school, and does that, in accordance with your experience, is that a good idea, or should students be looking to do something else first, as Tom suggests?
Well, I think to answer your second question first, it depends on what you as a law graduate are interested in, how you think you want to take your career. And yes, there are companies that hire people straight out of law school. I've done it in the past. I do it in the future. what I think makes the difference is what skill level, what particular expertise the company needs at that point in time, and does the company at that point in time and the other attorneys in that company have the luxury right then of teaching and mentoring somebody, because that's what you have to do, and law firms are structured to do that. And to some extent, government is structured to do that. Companies aren't really structured to do that, so you kind of have to hit a company at the right time. I've hired recent law graduates and liked hiring recent law graduates because I think that what they lack in expertise, they make up for in enthusiasm and willingness to try new things. I think sometimes when you spend a lot of time in a firm and you've got a particular area that you're well versed in, you've spent a lot of time investing in that area, and sometimes you might be a little more reluctant to try something new, or you might be a little more reluctant to lose some of your skills. So you might not be very willing to go into new areas that the company might want to push you into because the company needs to do that. But again, it depends all on how much time and how willing the company is to mentor somebody, teach somebody, bring somebody along.
Byron mentioned that there are a number of CEOs now who used to be general counsels. Is the path through a general counsel's office and perhaps to the top of a general counsel's office a path sometimes, in your view, to something else? And is it a good path for someone who might be interested in higher levels of management in a company? Jeff?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the business of Carlyle is to buy companies, and when we buy control, often we insert a new management team, not always. I would say in a very large number of cases when we acquire companies, the senior management that we'll impose on the management team for that portfolio company will have legal experience. And just offhand, I can think of a number of cases where the person we hire, you hire a recruiter and they do a search, and very often we find lawyers. Increasingly in today's environment where after all of the scandals in the mutual fund industry and the Enron experience, lawyers are usually a little more keenly aware of responsibilities that management has to the company and to its shareholders. So by virtue of my observation on of the companies that we acquire and our practice with them, I would say being a lawyer, and most of those lawyers usually come from an in-house position, not from a firm, is an excellent route at some point to join senior management and become CEO. In my role at Carlyle, this is an interesting question. Carlyle is still a fairly young organization. We've never really had to deal with the issue of succession because the founders of the company are still there. They still run the place. But I fully expect, if I want to stay at Carlyle, that when the founding partners who currently run Carlyle retire, I think that I and some other lawyers on my staff will certainly step up in roles increasingly as management of the company and less as lawyers. There are some examples of that already beginning to happen where lawyers on my team jump to the deal side. I think that's secretly the desire that everyone who comes to work at Carlyle harbors is to be a deal guy. And I expect to do that at some point, and I think there's a great opportunity there to do that.
Tom, can you elaborate on a similar theme and perhaps talk about the kinds of skills that you would advise young people to try to acquire if they're interested in a career within a corporation?
Well, I think the So I echo Byron's comment from earlier. Knowing your way around a financial statement and, frankly, being able to follow the shifting sands in the accounting industry as they change their mind every 6 months about fairly important topics is absolute top-level importance, especially for public companies, I think. I'm not so sure it necessarily is quite the same level of importance in a private company scenario, but definitely if you're in the legal area in a public company and you don't know financial statements, if you have a transaction-oriented practice and you don't know financial statements, you are hurting and severely hurting, and you're not really adding the value you could add in an important legal position. Beyond that, I think, frankly, the most important talent is probably twofold. Number one is curiosity. I think you really have to have an active sense of wanting to know everything there is to know about the business, because if you really don't understand how the business works, I think the legal advice you give is very sterile in the end. It is not informed by the factors and the motivations that are basically central to the entity that you serve. The other thing that I think is important is you have to have a keen sense of knowing when you're out of your depth. It's all well and good to say you need a broad-based generalist, and I would say, frankly, that's the school that I came from, generalist. They said, you need to specialize in something at my old law firm. And I said, yeah, I have a specialty. I specialize in getting done what my clients want done. But I think the recent example that strikes me is Larry Sonsini. I mean, you want to talk about a smart lawyer, just whip smart. But by the same token, he's the guy that sat in the room and basically nodded his head in a legal area that I'm sure he never encountered before and probably hopes he never encounters again. So you really, I think, need to basically have a sense of no matter how good you are, at some point nobody's that good, and knowing when you have to seek outside help and to say, no matter if people are looking to me to be the person, there are times when you have to say, I'm sorry, but I can't give you what you need. We need to bring somebody else in.
Byron, you've got a lot of administrative hats in your company as well as being the chief lawyer for the company. Do you find any tension between those roles? Do you find that it's hard to be an administrator and a lawyer at the same time?
I think the comments up here about being a generalist and thinking clearly and analytics being clear and framing analytics and practical problem solving in business extends to a lot of the other roles you may have as an administrator, and I guess we share some of those things as well. The tension today in terms of running other parts of the business is that you find yourself running into your own ethical quandaries when you've got to essentially strike contracts and deals for the company in a variety of areas, and then you've got to also be the one who reports out on Sarbanes-Oxley ethical issues for the company as well as do investigations for the company. So I think I probably have a heightened sense of ethical and governance fiduciary responsibility, and as a result, when I do deals on behalf of the company and other areas that affect the company's operations, I always take that hat with me. Because I have to also set an example for the rest of the business people in the company as to how you do deals that mitigate risk best for the company, even though in those particular roles I'm doing deals for the company and not necessarily rendering legal advice. The other thing I would say, and we've been talking about how to prepare yourself to be a general counsel, and I would just add a couple things that have helped me not only in being a general counsel but in being an administrator, you become even more relevant to the business across a number of areas, is that I'm more technology savvy over time than I've ever been. I'm very aware of technology trends and how they apply to the business, and in our world of media and information, that's key. But it's also key for being general counsel, because if you look at the government alphabet soup of laws and regulations, a lot of them deal with the implications of how technologies store and forward and process information. So even if you're a litigator, and you ultimately become general counsel, you need to know everything you should know about how the Internet stores and forwards information, because if you've been watching all the corporate scandals, a lot of them come back to emails and databases, and the same thing's true of the government. And so if you don't know technology today, I think it's hard for you to be relevant, not only as an administrator, but as a lawyer to a business. The other thing I would say is, and I think somebody else mentioned this, you really do have to know the government. For better or for worse, I left here and focused on a government regulatory practice, both as an administrator and as a lawyer for the company, because I'm very comfortable with government regulation, government law, and the implementation of that, and also dealing with government agencies. You know, I don't fear the big hand of government affecting the company. I'm very comfortable with that role. On the other hand, if you don't know government regulation and government laws and how they implicate businesses, then you're really a step behind what you can do for the company. Not only as a lawyer, but also as an administrator, because if I go out and buy technology for the company that allows us to transmit programming around the world, you know, and I don't understand that I have to coordinate frequencies with the FCC and other administrative bodies in Canada and in different continents of the world, then I don't really know my business. And so it's hard to actually be an effective administrator today without knowing government and government regulations and their implications for the business.
Sharon, what kind of training do you recommend for young lawyers who are looking at going to general counsel's offices?
Well, speaking just strictly for the type of business that our company's in, I'd like to put in a plug for the federal contractors of the world. Because our company, even though we're a subsidiary of a huge telecommunications company, our U.S. subsidiary is strictly a government contractor. And a government contractor is a whole different kind of animal entirely. If you're going to work for a government contractor, or even as outside counsel advise a government contractor, you have to understand what makes government contractor tick. The rules and regulations that we live under are pervasive. And as a matter of fact, when Sarbanes-Oxley came along, and our company before it was acquired was publicly traded, we had a real easy time complying with Sarbanes-Oxley, because just about everything Sarbanes-Oxley required, we already had to be doing in some form or another as a government contractor. Our government partners, auditors, IGs, everybody, you know, they live right here on a daily basis. And if you want to work for a company in that particular arena, you really do need to know something about government contracts before you go there. You know, you need to know the relevant regulations. You need to know how to read the relevant regulations, and you need to understand all the different agencies that will look at your employer every hour of every day of every week of the year. I think you need to have an appreciation for business if you want to be an in-house counsel. I think you need to have, and as everybody has said already, you need to really appreciate the business that your employer does. You need to understand it. You need to be interested in it. You have to have a good sense of curiosity, because you need to get out there. You can't sit in your office. You need to get out there and talk to people. I think that you definitely have a background in finance. You know, some kind of understanding of accounting is going to serve you so well when you walk in the door. You really should have that understanding. If you're going to work for a services company, you should have some understanding of employment law. If you're going to work for an IT company, you should have some understanding of intellectual property, even just passing. So that when you go into the door of that company, you are going to be able to walk down the halls and have some understanding of the issues that you're going to encounter. And when you get there, you need to remember that, you know, sometimes outside counsel has the luxury of saying to a company, you really should look into this area. Let me know if you need my help. But inside, you don't have that luxury. If you say to somebody in your company, you really need to look into this area, you, saying it, you're the one that's going to have to look into it. You cannot let it go. You know, it's not something that you can say to your CEO, let me know if you want me to help you. No, you're going to have to keep on that issue and make sure that it is looked into and dealt with if it's a problem.